Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey everyone, welcome to my turn. I think I just scared Rob.
No, I was just disappointed you didn't say mom said it's my turn.
Yeah, you do it every time.
Mama.
It feels like we stumbled into your apartment. Like, hey.
Welcome. It's New York, my turn here. Welcome to My Turn, the podcast where we pick movies that are tangentially related in an order with which I've long forgotten.
An inspiring Waypoint listener produce a website that just says who picks next.
Who picks next? Yes.
So please. I could go whopicksnext.com and God it just says it. the next one is knowing that we go, you know, through and then back. Yes. And like you know, even listening, you can figure it out the order.
There's some weird jumps because of the listener pick, so just figure it out. It'll be fine. This time, I almost said this week, as if we were doing this weekly. This time on my turn, we watched Mandy, the 2018. Sorry,
Waypoint's pick of the week. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. The first Waypoint.
Oh my God. Did anyone go back and listen to that? Did anybody double check whether or not we actually talked about that movie? Because I feel like we didn't talk.
We did talk about the movie. Yeah.
God damn it.
Discussion.
Why would you go back and listen to it? Like, what are you doing with your time? I have too little time. The notion of going back to completely listen to our Mandy discussion as a refresher before this is unhinged behavior, but live your life.
Couldn't be me. Mandy, the 2018 horror? Honestly, we can get back to that. It's like weird because, it got called a horror movie a lot, but you know, there's genre lines are always so fuzzy. But filmed by, I don't recommend it
to someone who has liked a horror movie before, even if I would agree with you on what the genre, like aesthetically and gore fought wise, it is pulling enough that's like, look. You might want to watch Nick Cage like thrash around in a bathroom. Who wouldn't? But
yes.
Also, you're going to watch him shove a pike through a man's face very slowly as his face disintegrates. God.
Yeah. Panos.
Cosmantos?
I don't know why I have such a tough time. Because it's Cosmatos. Right?
Pretty sure.
Okay.
Pretty sure.
So there's
second film.
So
right?
Yeah, he's the son of George P. Cosmatos, who was a pretty well regarded director of like the 80s, did Rambo First Blood Part 2, but also like directed Tombstone. Or did he? Because there's like longstanding rumors that he kind of was overwhelmed by making that movie and Kurt Russell effectively stealth directed it. But either way,
this is a poltergeist situation. Also did Leviathan. That's a great cheesy B movie horror.
Nice.
Highly recommended.
I ended up picking Mandy partially on a very strong aesthetic association I had. With like just kind of like this the kind of mythos of these two movies, like the like it's not quite magical realism, but like that sense of like the where the edge of like the real and imagined and kind of mythological worlds blend was like a big reason that where I was like, yeah, this is where we can go next. Also, like, jumping back to, was it two movies ago that we watched Green Knight?
It was Green Knight was the one before also last.
Also, accidentally attaching the red
and really magic. Green Knight's the movie I actually found myself thinking about a lot as I watched this, just in terms of, like, visually and just some of the camera work.
Definitely like had thought of that movie, had thought of Mandy when we were watching that movie, but then watching The Lighthouse also was like, wait a second, there's still a connection. There's a connection here that I think is still very strong, and I was like, fuck it, let's do it.
Well, I mean, like, if there's one piece of connective tissue between The Lighthouse and Mandy, it is, like, some of the most bold production decisions that I've seen my entire life, right? Like, they are both movies that are, like, fully committed to an aesthetic in such a way that is, like, I think really cool. I think they're both very fun to watch in their understanding of the tools that they have given themselves. The like strobing lights every single time that
they pull out, like
one of the characters in this film pulls out an artifact.
Yeah.
Whether it be the horn of Abraxas or the despoiled blade.
The despoiled blade.
When like the green light starts strobing as he picks it up, it's just like this is a movie that is so much a damn movies can be like this movie for me in terms of just like fully leaning into style and like being a weird tone poem to like throw out everything else, just be a collection of images in a way that I like absolutely adore.
Yeah, it's like what like medium format film and sea shanties are to the Lighthouse. This is like late 70s, early 80s, like heavy metal, like all those like wild cosmic and or just like high fantasy illustrations that
I mean literally sort of heavy
music.
Metal, right?
Yes,
like
yes, exactly.
Like the animated film, like, you know,
the animated film, yeah.
Like I don't know, I haven't read enough to know if that is a specific inspiration on this, but I cannot help but I never saw the animated film, but like the box art is like enshrined in my mind because I would always see it at the video store, and I couldn't help but look at this and just see like a direct connection, even if I have no idea if it literally exists as a aesthetic inspiration.
Well, I mean, even just sideways, because like heavy metal was inspired obviously by those illustrations. Like, what if we made all the heavy metal illustrations into a cartoon?
So a thing about this is that the axe from Mandy is actually based off of the F in Celtic Frost, which is the name of a, I believe, Icelandic heavy metal band. Yeah, no, not Icelandic. It's a a heavy metal band. The F in Frost is exactly what the axe, the battle axe that Red inexplicably forges, is like used for. It's incredible. It's
spectacular. This movie has a sort of structure that is interesting, because it's kind of taken this it's a revenge movie, right? And it has this like setup where you think like, okay, like this woman's going to get fridged, and you expect it, honestly, just because of genre conventions, to happen much earlier than it does. But the first half of the movie really kind of takes a long time setting up Red and Mandy's like relationship, and like really kind of makes, I feel like, the revenge part of it later hit a lot better for me in the end. What did y'all feel, like, how did y'all feel about the first, like, half of this movie?
I mean, like, the first half of this movie is, like, deeply compelling to me because it is using a lot of the same aesthetic tools that the second half of the movie does, but is applying them to, like, human interaction that is just off of like what we expect from people talking to one another, right? Like the conversation that Mandy and Red have about the starlings is like just such an uncomfortable scene for like so many reasons, and it is like done expertly. The color grading as it like hangs on her face. And so I think that like the execution is so good that even if like it's a little bit long in the tooth, I kind of don't care because every single scene is like doing something new with how to make me uncomfortable with two people just talking to each other, whether it be Mandy and Red or Sand and anyone in his cult, literally yeah. anyone who God. He's a pervert around in different ways for all of them, which is like, damn, he can't even be consistent with how he's a freak. And so like, I really, really like the way this movie is paced. And then the second half is just tremendous. The first moment that I was like, that I knew that I was like really gonna love this movie, even if I never watch it again, was when, because that's probably the case, was when the first Black Skull is, after Red is captured and he's in the Black Skull's like lair, which feels like a lair. It is shot yeah. like a dungeon, despite obviously being like, just like a home in the middle of nowhere. When he breaks off the pole and then smacks the Black Skull, who just falls down a bottomless pit that is next to him
yeah.
for no reason. There is no reason for that bottomless
pit. For all
pit
the
to
reasons, actually.
Yeah.
No, exactly, would, to Patrick. The contrary, no, exactly. I would argue differently.
Spoken like someone who's never had need of a cistern.
And so the bottomless pit suddenly becomes like, okay, cool. We're fully in dream logic at this point.
And then
this
they're is back like, 30 seconds later to join the fight from the bottomless pit.
What?
Yeah. The person he kicks down the bottomless pit. I was like, is that the same biker? And it is, because he starts screaming, "You ripped my shirt. You ripped my shirt." It kills them again.
Yeah.
So like it's not even the logic is not even consistent to the point of like kick the biker into the abyss. The biker's gone. No. The biker emerges into the fight in the living room like 2 minutes later.
With a shotgun. You're right.
Yeah. Fuck. I remember when I first watched this movie being like, that's a funny acting and dialogue choice by Nick Cage, but he's just being weird. But then like, yeah, it hit me. Oh, He's just signaling, by the way, this is the guy that got kicked down the hole earlier.
Which I will note, I don't think Nick Cage makes any, like, surprising choices in this. I think Nick Cage is fucking killing it. This yeah. performance is incredible for many reasons, one of which is, like, the way he just, like, growls nonsense through fight scenes. It's incredible. I love it.
I mean, to your original question about the beginning of the film, like I've watched countless, you know, whether they're just like revenge tales or revenge tales wrapped in horror films. And you're right. Like the genre convention is, what do you want to call it? Fridging or whatever, is just like set up a visceral attack almost exclusively of a woman. Or if it isn't a woman, the woman is probably being sexually assaulted in the process right. to set up the revenge. And what's like beautiful in this movie is that for a film that is broadly vibes and is deeper than just aesthetic, but I feel like vibes is a way of articulating that, is that it, I think the fact that it's uncomfortably long in setting up the relationship is purposeful, so that those long shots you get of Cage when, you know, she's burned, like feel all the more impactful, because too often in these films they do the exact opposite, which is that these people, this character exists purely as a motivating factor. And maybe you get a moment where they kiss and have sex and like, he's like, oh, they love each other. Mm. But you don't really buy it. Like, no, few films would include, you're right, the starling scene or the scene where they're talking about the stars and he cracks the Galactus joke, which is was my one of my favorite moments in the original film, like original watching of this, and was all the better here, both for, I think it's a lot of what I appreciated my first time through of watching the first half was the vibes of it, because the aesthetic is so strong. And yeah. Then upon second viewing, a lot of what I appreciated was this more subtle character work that is going on for a movie that, you know, is pretty thin on plotting, but is surprisingly heavy on character.
Yeah.
And those two characters, like having that time with one another where the shots linger, every shot in this movie lingers long, right? Like that is one of his defining features visually. And that extends to these character scenes that just don't cut and go on for a couple more lines. And I really appreciated that, especially the second time around, because it's such a deliberate choice in the film where it's 2 hours. You can easily see the cuts where you get it to 90 and it's quote unquote tighter. But I think it's not quite a tension, but there is something generated by the length, especially early on. I think partially because it runs counter to, I know what this movie is. Mm-hmm. When the hell are we getting to that part?
Right.
And the longer it drags it out, the more as a viewer, it just generates an energy for the film that you're waiting to snap a bit.
So I think partly also, I think you can't cut the movie down without doing violence to the way it interacts with Johan Johansson's soundtrack. Like mm-hmm. the movie unfolds at the pace of like a Prague ambient album. Yeah. And so like I think the two, the sound of Mandy and the pacing of Mandy are so bound together that this is, you know, this kind of has to be a movie that like unfolds slowly and lingers over details and moments. I think not to, you know, almost reiterate some issues I had with The Lighthouse, but I think once again, I find myself with a film here where I am much more engaged by the first two thirds of the film mm. than I am by the final third. Like it is absolutely true that like, of course something goes out of the film when Andrea Riseborough's Mandy is killed. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, very much the point, but also there is so much good work being done that first half of the film of, yes, like establishing their life together, getting a sense of like who Mandy is. You never know her full story, right? Mm-hmm. But you have a sense of these are two people who feel a bit hunted by the world and have retreated from it. And like, I don't know, it is such a, it walks a very fine line in a way that's really compelling by the fact that on the one hand, it's kind of grounded in this like hangover from the 60s vibe where, you know, the Manson family equivalent is still mm-hmm. wandering the highways. You know, you still have like reactionary politics are going strong as the Reagan. You know, voiceover reminds us. But at the same time, against that, where like he's a Manson style cultist, and you know he's obsessed with this woman Mandy, he's going to kidnap her. Also, like demons exist, but they're like a biker gang, and you do have this sense of like a recognizable reality lives right next to, oh yeah, but also of course we need to get this blade from the abyssal plane so that we can like kidnap our next victim, and that will require some human sacrifice. And that's, everyone's like, yeah, of course, that's yeah. real. That's, yeah, that's that exists in this world.
Yes, 100%.
The other thing is that like, I think my other thing about the pacing is that Mandy and Rhett are such weird fucking people. They're just two little weirdos, and the movie gives them the space to be weirdos who care about each other very much and in like very quiet ways, right? Like they don't need to have,
treat them like weirdos though, right?
No,
like, I think
no.
you can come away with that sense that these are really eccentric people and how they arrive here. But I also think the movie does not, is not condescending to the two of them, which is different than how a lot of films would treat these two characters.
Right. Like the conversation they have about the stars could so easily have turned into a like, look at these two freaks in the woods who did drugs and then talked about the stuff. Like it's so easy to like let that aesthetically slip into something that is like you said, Patrick, condescending. And the film never does it. And instead like gives them the space to be like unabashedly little freaks who love each other very much. The opening scene where Red looks at the illustration that Mandy is doing, and we never get to see the illustration, but he looks at it and he goes, like, he's genuinely in awe of the work that she does. And like the two of them so deeply love Pulp Fiction and like heavy metal covers and like existing in that space. And it's I think like really, really endearing and does so much to inform the aesthetics of the second half of this movie, right? Of course, after your girlfriend who you are deeply in love with, who does like fantasy and like heavy metal style illustration work, after she's killed, of course the film is bathed in red and dealing with demonic bikers, right? This is a movie in which like a man is completely broken and the one thing he had to hold on to like becomes the aesthetic core of his violence.
I also think there's like, I don't know, they are eccentric, but I think the thing that comes through so much is like, like, we don't know how Mandy gets her, like, facial scar, for instance. We don't know that story, but we do know the story she tells about her father and, like, killing those starlings because, they stole the cherries off his tree. But really, it's more than that, right? Like, there's just, like, male rage is a thing that is in the backdrop of that story. And just the cruelty of people, the cruelty of the world, the fact that he shows up and he does this. And in the story, he also makes the children learn that cruelty. He teaches that lesson. And Mandy is someone who sees a, like, dead baby deer and is shattered by the experience. Like, that she's, like, hyper attuned to grief and loss for all creatures, right? She has a sort of universal empathy, and that does make her weirdo. That does make her slightly alienated from the world, and it makes Red that much more special that she feels safe with him, because we know this is someone who this does not seem like comes easily too. But against the backdrop of that, we also see, you know, she's always wearing a metal band t-shirt, always. her art is the type of art that graces the covers of the sci-fi and fantasy novels she reads. She and Cage are comics nerds at a time when that still is very much kind of a subculture.
Right.
And so, like, there's this, and with Cage too, I get the sense of, certainly later, when he has the "it's time to go back to the old me" moment, there's an implication that, like, Bill Duke, whatever the background is, like, Nick Cage has fucked people up before.
Yeah.
And there's this vibe of, like, this is like Eastwood's gunslinger in Unforgiven, where it's like, I'm not this guy anymore. I don't want to do this anymore. Put that behind me. But when summoned to action, there's going to be some bloodshed. But Cage too, we get the sense of, he has chosen a job that, like, it is the most isolated job he can pick. He's a lumberjack that gets flown out to deep backwoods to work for days or weeks at a camp. And then is flown back out to not even quite like, civilization, still very much on the cusps of it. You know, he's still deep in the wilderness, just like in sort of the settled parts of the wilderness. And I think get a little implication. Do we see him drink before Mandy is killed?
There's on the helicopter, one of his coworkers offers him a drink. And you definitely get the sense that it's not only it is both signaling like he might do other things but not alcohol, and then but also obviously the like sort of sense of him being like, more of a loner.
He's not one of the guys at all. But I got like ex-alcoholic vibes.
Right. I mean, that's the thing that I was thinking, Rob, is like that vodka is not like, he doesn't go to the kitchen. He goes into a little corner in his bathroom underneath like three different things to find a single bottle of vodka in the entire home, right? Like that is the way people hide things.
It has to keep it, like when he begins to drink it, is at one point has to like force it back into his mouth. Like it is not as though, the sweet release of finally being able to do this thing I've been fighting against. There is like this tension that is snapping in this moment where he has to actually force it down his throat to summon the courage to do the actions that he feels need to happen next. And I'm with you, Rob. Like there's a real darkness between both these two characters. And I think it's what makes the relationship all the sweeter, because I think like the broad implication is two broken, troubled people that managed to find solace in one another and become people they didn't think were possible. And the actions that occur in the film, well, we don't see what happens to Mandy necessarily. I certainly think it's reasonable to assume, like, situations flipped. Mandy would have tracked down the hunting rifle too and tried her best. It's not how we see relationships portrayed. This is not how we see love expressed on film, and it is not usually allowed for characters, or if they were troubled, if they had like these kinds of shady or however past, however you want to characterize it, that'd be more of a plot point. Be like, hey, like these are some dark motherfuckers. And like you can watch this film and sort of that can wash over you. Like it is not lingered on. It is not like forwarded. And I find that to be a really beautiful part of how the two are portrayed.
Yeah. One thing that really stood out to me, was the first time we see Mandy and Red on screen together, Mandy like gets up and stands on the chair she was sitting on. And like one of the most awkward maneuvers I've ever seen a person execute with their body. And it looks like an outtake at first in terms of like, just like how awkwardly she moves through that space. But it is such like an endearing character moment and like a really good summation of like the relationship that we see after that moment forward, where it's like these two weird, awkward people who like really bring the best out of one another, or at least like bring comfort out of one another. And in that comfort are able to become better versions of themselves. And then to see that like taken away, like one of the things that I was looking at like reviews of this movie. And one of the things that I saw is that people were talking like Cage's performance is not just like a sad or angry man. Cage is performing as someone who is utterly and fundamentally destroyed by what happens in this movie. He is gone after Mandy is burnt in a way that is like, I think the first half of the film really sets up why that is, why he is utterly and fundamentally destroyed and turned into something wholly different by that violence.
Mm-hmm. And I would also say like, it seems, and you would think, you're going to get, as at that moment, you'll get like what we kind of come to regard as the stereotypical Cage performance, right? Like scenery chewing, like very broad,
especially in genre films, right? Like he is like, there's this comes, you know, Mandy is essentially like is part of a signaling of a kind of a renaissance of Cage being in even genre or non-genre fare in which he's being more celebrated and appreciated, but like, this is a man that has been a lot of like film shot in Romania for, you know, like cheap budgets, and he puts on a performance, but it is not necessarily one that is controlled and focused.
But when he is forced, when the camera just holds on him while she's burned, and you just see the denial, the horror, the agony, the pain, the resignation, all that pass through in that moment. Mm-hmm. And you come out the other side of that. And then, I mean, the photography and direction gets a lot of credit here, too. We go from the heightened, demonic dream state of, like, the cult carrying out their plan and murdering Mandy. And then we, like, the thing that's maybe most devastating is after seeing, like, Cage overwhelmed by all that, the music lets up. We get a cut to now normal color grading. It's just the outside of their home lit by the exterior floods. Everyone's getting in their cars. It's quiet. It's the sound of door latches, people walking across grass, and the cult departs. And we are firmly back in reality.
Yeah.
but it's a reality transformed by this all actually happened. Like Mandy is dead. Yeah. Like her ashes are still smoldering there. And it is like we see him go through that agony. And then I think it's such a brilliant move to transition to this moment where they're like, this is the nature of like grief and life. You have to get up. You have to go over to your house. You have to get cleaned up. You have to put on your clothes. You have to like, you have to do all these things, even though this like horrible thing just happened and he is overwhelmed by it. Like your home is still your home. All your shit's still there. The person you lost, their stuff is still there. It was there. Like they were there, you know, just a day ago. Now everything's transformed, but everything's the same. And the movie hits that so perfectly well. The mundanity of handling like the mundanity of the world after dealing with that overwhelming grief, and the Cheddar Goblin's an inspired fucking
it's so good. It's so good. I can't stop thinking about it.
I do love this moment you're speaking to, especially because at this point, we have seen the like the demons being summoned and like we're starting to get into that, like, you know, there was the whole session where Mandy's been drugged and like it's very psychedelic and it's
which we should talk world. About extensively because it's a great fucking scene.
Oh my god. But I think the decision to hard cut back to like very kind of much more stand as they're leaving and getting into the car, it's just showing the like, I don't know, it makes the kind of callousness with which that character like treats all of obviously all other people, but like obviously has so little regard for other human life, like that much more stark to me when it cuts from this kind of like overwhelming like I'm basically a messiah whatever bullshit to like and there he goes, just kind of a guy getting into a van, right? Like I was just gonna say, it just really heightens that sort of like, you know, the banality of evil situation that's going on there.
But one thing I'll say is after this, like after we get the normal color grading, he walks into the bathroom and turns the lights on, and it is just awash in color and like disorienting in how like vibrant that bathroom is.
The bathroom's like straight out of like the late 70s as far as its color choices.
Carpeted, wall to wall. Right. Bold.
Right. Ugh. It's bold, it's carpeted wall to wall, and then he grabs the vodka. And it feels like that is a transition point to me aesthetically, where he looks at the real world and goes, or the normal world, and it goes, actually, no, I am going to fully commit to going into this dark place. Or going into this place of like aesthetic and vibes, right? I am going to go to the vibe dimension by walking into this fucked up bathroom, drinking a bunch of vodka, and then coming out back into this like vivid and vibrant color palette that then carries through what feels like the rest of the movie. Other than the conversation with Carruthers.
In that whole scene, it's almost like he is making a choice about how much he's going to release over this, like, because there's the moment of like disbelief as he stumbles back inside and you know, he wears that shirt in the film, but she's also wearing it for a good portion of the film, right? Like the baseball shirt, and so he holds it to himself for a moment, and then like we makes it into the bathroom. It's like this wonderful building action to when he finally just starts screaming and wailing at what has happened here, but like almost as a choice of like this is like there's no suppressing this, like I do feel this way, this is like it's going to be raw, it's going to be hard, and it's a wonderful scene. I'm so curious. You know, I've seen people on film Twitter talking about that. If you see movies in person now, there's a horrible trend where people laugh instinctively at uncomfortable stuff in films, or they decide like they like just ironic like detachment to like, I'm going to choose to find this funny. And I was thinking like, I feel like the image of him in the shirt and little tidy whities and like covered in blood, I can almost see an audience like, is this funny? Is this like time for the goofy, like there goes Nick Cage. Mm. And I think he's made movies where that scene is played for goofy, you know, where it is just kind of heightened and ridiculous. But it isn't here. I think the entire sequence is beautiful.
Well, I mean, I think it has that moment to let you to like be really obvious with Cheddar Goblin right before that, where it's like, this is what this movie thinks is maybe funny, or like there's something that you can laugh at here for a second before we get into like the thing that you're right, like it feels like they let a little bit of release happen there before it like gets really, really intense, you know.
The other thing I'll say is that I think that this is a movie where, you know, talking about like that uncomfortable laughter, I think that frequently that uncomfortable laughter can be the result of like incongruity or what feels like incongruity to an audience. And I think that if there's one thing that Mandy does, it is establish a vibe so early that the minute you see him in that fucking bathroom, you know that this is not being played for laughs, because this is just the palette that this movie works in. This is the like emotional like tone and tenor that has been spread throughout. And I think that for me, like, I don't know how you could see that scene and read it as goofy, given everything that has happened to the point in this movie, from like a how aesthetics and like scenes are constructed to this point. I think it does a really good job of establishing a internal logic or lack thereof, and then communicating that to the audience and then committing to it for the rest of the movie.
Yeah, but you cast Cage and baggage comes with that,
of course,
right? Like, you don't cast Cage solely on, I think, is a terrific actor. Like you know, that there is a Nick Cage is both stunt casting and also actual casting. And so I think part of what the line that scene dances is audience expectation, audience baggage. It's not as explicit as like a, what was that film that came out last year where it's actually like a meta commentary on Cage's career.
Incredible. The weight of incredible whatever or something.
Yeah. That movie was not as good as I wanted it to be, but it's very charming and it's fine. I think that's part of why that scene works, is because if you've watched Cage for decades, and I think that a lot of people going into that scene have the weight of that on their shoulders. It's like, all right, here's the wind up. Like, here's Cage doing Cage stuff. And it's true, but I think it also is communicated that this is a kind of like animalistic anger. Like, I really appreciated that the general way that film, and especially like revenge, like horror films that are going to portray grief is, I mean, it's all the same sort of, people are crying and they're sad and like that stuff happens. Like, I've been through plenty of grief before, but there is a, a comparison I could make to like a television show like The Leftovers, which is that actually grief is you just wanting to punch a fucking window, and that what you do is you perform grief in a different way for everybody else. But when you are left alone by yourself, you mostly just want to destroy something and scream. And like, I felt that in that scene. And yeah, like that is what I profoundly appreciated about it, was like, actually, like, if this was to happen to me, I don't think I'd be crying. I think I'd be screaming, looking for that bottle of vodka too.
Yeah. God. One thing I will note about like a trivia fact that I did read that I think is useful here. Originally, Cage was supposed to be cast as Sand.
If you were doing the typecasting of Cage, that 100% makes sense.
And then he said no. They were like, hey, we want you to be Jeremiah Sand. This is a film about the old and the young, blah, 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 blah. And Cage is like, fuck no, what? And then a year later, they talked again, and the film had transitioned to something about like loss and like what it means to love someone and what it means to lose love and like lose your footing in the world. And then Cage was like, yes, I would like to be in this movie as Red. And then the director was like, okay, yeah, let's do it. Which I think is a really cool story of like how the film's even like basic themes shifted over the course of a year, which then allowed Cage to actually take on a role that feels like almost made for him, right? Like it feels this is a movie that like Cage's performance in this feels to me the same way that like Adam Sandler's does in Uncut Gems, where it's like, this is a guy who, this is a role that has been basically tailor-made for this one particular person to bring all of the baggage of their previous movies into it and then play with that.
I want to talk a little bit about, well, Sand, like, I mean, the path not taken is Cage's Sand. I think Linus Roach's Sand is, I mean, by design, the character is not that interesting, right? Like, he's a monstrous, heavy-handed manipulator. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We see him, like, no sooner is he sees Mandy, he becomes immediately obsessed with her. We see the way he interacts with members of his cult, sort of the ways he controls them or enables them, as it were. But I think something that, like, we talked about, like, you know, this movie, you know, you could say the inciting event is a fridging, but I think that they get beyond that because, like, the way Mandy handles the situation and what she does to Sam, the fact that, like, it is, like, what causes him to rage out and, like, murder her is the fact that she sees him very clearly despite mm-hmm. his efforts to the contrary via the drugs, via the pretensions. She sees him very quickly and can't help herself. finds him pathetically funny. No. And like the sequence is, it is such a good, like, it is such a great sequence because we have him, he's arranged his whole little tableau after she's been drugged by like the, you know, hallucinogenic wasp sting and the eye drops and such. He's arranged his whole little tableau with his little followers and he's in his little robe and he wants to talk to her about music. And immediately he's just like, buddy, have you called the wrong shot? Because we know Mandy's like a metalhead. And he's like, have you ever heard of the Carpenters? I think they're sensational. And it's like, but like, it's 1983. Like, no matter what you think of the Carpenters, they're not like his shtick, his music, the fucking hippie, like flower children shit that he's into. Its moment is past. He's, mm-hmm. he's old. You know, he is out of step and deeply uncool. And he is trying to present himself as this like awesome guru type figure. But then even better off, he put the Carpenters on because instead he puts on his like little, maybe he got an actual album pressed. Maybe it's vanity pressing. I don't know. But
yeah, I think vanity pressing was a big deal back then.
Like, yeah, just he puts that shit on with the like, I've been blessed with the gift of music. And it's that refrain of
first line? Well, it's so,
because every man must take. But what's the first line?
Every seed that gives us life. Hold on, every man must take a wife.
Yes, like, yes, yes, yes.
It's like blatantly creepy and sexual, but like trying to be coy about it, but. And the fact that like he's building up to this, like convincing her to like join his cult and have sex with him. And but crucially, as he's doing it, it's also just a like literally a masturbation ritual. Mm-hmm. You know, he disrobes and he begins trying to get himself off. And she's drugged, but she's taking all this in and getting increasingly lucid. And like she signs her death warrant. Almost knowingly, she says, what do you see when you look? When he says, what do you see when you look at me? She says, I see the Reaper approaching. It turns out the crossbow is named the Reaper. but, you know, she's sort of seen at this moment the way this is all going to play out. Mm-hmm. That like all of this is going to get everyone killed. And it's going to start with her. And she kind of chooses to cut this guy down. Did you write this? And then just bursts into laughter.
Yeah.
And when she sees it, and when she sees it's making him angry, she laughs harder. And like digs the thumb in deeper. And like effectively like destroys him, right? Like Nicolas Cage is gonna come along later and kill him, but like this is the humiliation that he's like kind of been avoiding forever. It's a great sequence that, you know, the point of comparison I would make almost is there's a lot of media, but I think like it's typified by like Far Cry has gotten into this horrible pattern of like twisted villains are so charismatic and fascinating. Yeah. And here we have one who's like, I'm a twisted villain, I'm charismatic and fascinating. And basically, could have been the you're villain, talentless what's the, pervert.
What's the Far Cry one that takes place like in the quote Midwest, like there that has the whole religious cult aspect, right? Yeah. Like that's, I couldn't help but kind of think of that. Far Cry
5. Yeah.
Yes, that villain here, because you could just slot them in, except that one treats the villains as cool as shit.
and one thing that I think this movie does do actually pretty well is it's pretty considered about who it treats as, like, Jeremiah Sand is an abusive person, right? Is mm-hmm. fundamentally an abusive person. And the film like focuses on that above all else, right? Like under like his attempts at charisma, he's just fucking cruel consistently throughout the entire movie. And like, one of the things that I do appreciate is like there's the one moment Red doesn't kill one person in this movie, and it is this like person who has obviously just been like wildly and deeply abused by Sand into being present for all of this and into being like a place onto which reduced from a person into a place upon which violence is done, and like I think it's a really, really like, I think it's a depiction of cults and the people in them that is both like deeply empathetic and also does not have any patience for like abusive monsters in a way that I actually really appreciated.
Yeah, because he doesn't spare Marlene, the older one, because it's keenly aware, like to a degree, both the women in this cult are victims and also participants in what the cult is doing. But there's matters of degree.
Yeah.
That like Marlene has embraced this role and wields the power that comes with it, even though she's also being abused and manipulated. But like, Sister Lucy is clearly like, she's allowed to think she has agency, maybe, but for the most part is like completely under the control. And, you know, the like Nicolas Cage knows the score from the moment, you know, is a demonstration of his power. Sands does the load a bullet into the revolver and, you know, spin it thing before he burns Mandy.
And also the film's like, we don't see Marlene die. This movie was not interested in showing us Marlene dying because it was not like a fight. It was not like revenge. There was no action scene to be depicted there. It was just going to be like an act of violence that like is a foregone conclusion. And I think that like, again, that was like a pretty smart choice on their part to just like skip past that. We don't need that. We don't need that scene. It is much better if we just cut to the aftermath in a way that I like, again, I think is like smartly done and avoids some like easy pitfalls for like revenge horror like this, where it could like very easy turn into like violence against women torture porn. And I think it does an okay job of like not doing that.
Yeah. I think kind of one of the big differences we have between our like protagonists and the antagonists in this movie is a sort of ability, I guess, or skill to see kind of the truth of a person, I guess, right? Like like Sand has this like inflated sense of himself, and like everyone in the cult has been, you know, kind of, but like the way that Mandy kind of cuts him down by being able to, like, seeing his true self and kind of like, you know, seeing how pathetic he is, And Nick Red in that moment, knowing, kind of understanding that it's Lucy, right? That's her name, the one who he lets
yes,
go.
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
Knowing that Lucy is not bought in, has been, you know, like you were saying, kind of been held hostage in a sense here.
I think it comes to a similar point with like the chemist too. Well, I don't know. Hey, does What's he the kill chemist? The chemist? Yeah. Does he kill the chemist?
Wait, which one? Because there's two, right?
No, there's just character the called chemist. The chemist.
It's the dude with the tiger.
That's the only one. Okay, because I thought no. Okay, the sand character. I see. Okay, I misunderstood the way who the sand character was referring to the first time, because I thought he meant Marlene. Was
like, every other death is depicted on screen in
some way
fashion.
Or another, yeah. Right? Even Marlene's, which we don't
see the death.
We don't see Marlene die, but we see the aftermath of the head, death, yeah. Right? So I don't know.
Okay, I was just uncertain, because the way he frees the tiger is like a man who believes he is about to die, and so I was just interested to see how like other people walked away from that scene, because it is one of my favorite scenes in this movie. Yeah. Because it's like this lull in the violence where it's just like, what happens when a freak who's definitely like a weirdo comes into contact with what is effectively at this point a slasher villain, like a slasher movie, like villain. And the answer is that guy goes, I don't need this smoke. I'm going to go.
Yeah, we should actually, as you mentioned, take a break. And we'll get back to talk about the second half of this movie and how fucking wild it goes. Be right back.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
All right, and we're back. After, you know, a long up and down, like luxuriating, undulating first half of a movie. I mean, the music swells and comes down, up and down. Hold on, what? Come on. I think that's a good term. It undulates. We get Red, Nick Cage's character, basically going on a killing spree, going after the people who killed Mandy.
And first, he's got to check in with Bill Duke.
Yeah, he's got to find
Predator alum,
yeah,
Bill Duke.
Whose name is Carruthers. What a good fucking character name. I love Carruthers so much. The minute he's on screen, I am enthralled.
Yeah.
And again, blurring the line between how fantastical are we getting, because he tells the story of the bikers. In addition to have been holding on to Reaper, that crossbow that, you know, you've forsworn. And I've got special arrows that are really fuck people up, which again, like, are we in the arena
bone?
Right. And it's like, but there's only like three of them, and it's like,
they're magically imbued, obviously.
Yeah. For sure. That's the thing, right? Is like,
I take this movie at face value. Like, at no point do we enter the realm of fantasy. We have just entered a different realm. And they commingle and coexist.
Well, and because like he tells the story of like, well, the, you know, he gets the story out of Red as to what happened, and he describes the biker gang that was there, and he tells the story of, oh, well, people have heard about these bikers, a kind of a legend of the back highways. You know, the killing, you know, truckers and prostitutes and people just in their homes. But it all goes back to they got a hold of a, like, they were drug couriers until, you know, they got, I guess, you know, they crossed the dealer and cooked them up a special batch that turned them into these. What we meet later, but he's like trying to sell us on this notion of like, this was a normal everyday biker gang.
Yeah.
And they got hold of some bad shit. And they turned into guys who think they're demons.
Yeah.
But like, we've seen them. They are demons.
They are demons. They just are, yeah,
these
demons. Are,
these, like the closest analog are Cenobites from Hellraiser. Like the movie is directly ripping imagery. It's not like, you know, Hellraiser is specifically pulling from S&M aesthetic. This is not quite that, but it's adjacent to it. And like, these are Cenobites from another realm, like the ocarina that they're using,
yeah,
to summon them.
The Horn of Abraxas.
Sure. Yeah. This is just the one spell from Ocarina of Time that I couldn't find was to summon these creatures to take out Ganon. You know, that's the puzzle box from Hellraiser. Like that is 100% what's happening here. And like, I feel like that is, you know, with the movie is just suggesting there are things amongst us and they linger and they come between. And it's just, you know, if you have the right tool, you can summon and then give them, well, what charitably Rob said in a chat earlier was milk, but, you know, could be any number of substances.
One of my favorite things about the bikers is the fact that and onto like the fact that the Reaper feels like a magic crossbow at times, landing that shot on the dude on the bike is like basically impossible. That is a nearly impossible shot to fire through an entire like range of trees. A perfect,
we don't know what Cage did before,
into again, the
mysterious
throat of that
backstory
guy. Right. But after that, he then hits him with his car. And he does not hit him with his car in the way that people get hit by cars in movies generally. It looks like he hits a like concrete divider, the way his car reacts to hitting that man's body, which is just covered in like spikes and like pieces of metal. Mm-hmm. He is not a person anymore. He is a like a wholly other thing that is so much more resilient than like a human has ever been. And it fucking rules.
Yeah.
It rules so hard. And then it's the setup for knocking, now that I know this, knocking the guy down the bottomless pit only, yeah, to emerge later, apparently completely unharmed. These guys are like, they follow demon rules insofar as you have to cut their heads off or do something like it to actually kill them. It's so good.
I like to think that the pit is just, that's where they came out of. That's the pit to hell, and that's where they crawl out of. So he was just sending him home for a second, you know? He's like, oh yeah, sorry, everyone.
Oh, hi, Mom.
Bye, hi, Mom. I gotta go kill a guy. I'll be back.
You got more milk?
Got it.
Mommy milk.
It's not milk. Oh, it's too thick to be milk.
What do you think it is then, Kato?
I don't.
Any theories?
No.
You don't want to say what you think it is.
They're just fiends for horchata.
No. God.
They're like, it's. I'll bet it's tough to get horchata out in the backcountry like that.
And blood, so horchata.
They're like, horchata.
It's like the viscosity of like, what's it called?
Like lossy.
A smoothie.
No, it's thicker. It's thicker than that.
Yeah,
you think it's thicker than lossy?
It looks like what's the word? What's the thing I'm thinking of? It looks like Vaseline almost. Like, it's right.
There's also mentioned like the slime the kids play with these days, where, right, they make it just out of glue. Mm. That's all I could think,
yeah,
of looking at
just
this.
Glue.
This is just some homemade slime infused with God knows what.
Yeah. I do love, though, just as a kind of demonstration of how fucked up these people were on this stuff. Earlier, we see in the first scene, we see the magic goop. The guy comes up and like starts drinking it from the jar. Mm-hmm. Later, now Red in their home, like tasting the slightest bit of it, gets absolutely blasted into the farthest reaches of space by like the smallest amount. So just imagine what that would do to a human brain if you're fucking gulping it down like a big gulp.
Like, he encounters prophecy. Like he's not just blasted into space. He gets a fucking prophecy and then goes and fulfills it. And when he shows up, the chemist is like, "Damn, prophecy." Prophecy,
yeah.
Oh, it's so good. Look, what a good movie.
The potion seller was right. The strongest potion is too strong for you, traveler.
Potion seller. Enough of these games, man.
I need your strongest potion.
You can't handle my strongest potion.
There's also kind of something funny about like when Cage confronts them that like when the veil of their like they present, I mean, obviously they're like otherworldly,
yeah,
but also like they're kind of bitches. like Cage shouldn't be capable of doing this. Like the movie does not portray him as like a particularly capable fighter. He is just relentless. Like he will just not give up. Mm-hmm. And these creatures or whatever they are just not used to like, man, people just roll over and die. And like you will not do this. And so there's a real savagery to the way he, like when he, the humans, right? Mm-hmm. Like the cultists, it's more planned, mediated. There is a personal satisfaction that we're like, I'm going to do this and then execute it. Maybe chainsaw fight notwithstanding. But like with these, it's just a scrap. It's just a brawl. And there's just an audaciousness that a person showed up and even tried it where it's like, oh shit, they don't normally do this.
Well, I think that part of this is that like everyone who is not red in this film believes themselves to be immortal. Right? Like they are acting in the realms of like gods and devils insofar as like they are immortal beings and he is a mortal person. And like so much of this film is Red encountering a freak and reminding them of their mortality. Right? Like that's the whole thing with like, that's why the final confrontation with Sand is like Sand realizing he is a human being who can be touched for the first time in like what feels like years. And he just like absolutely loses his fucking mind. And I think that like, that is, to your point, Patrick, they believe that they are at this point immortal, which is why when Red slashes the throat of the one guy, he's not expecting it. Because he just, you're right. He believes he's an immortal being who will not die.
Well, or, I mean, I actually read it differently in that they don't exist on a plane of our interpretations mm-hmm. of immortal or mortal, and that their death is, all right, lost this one, like, time to go back, like, zoop,
well,
time to
zip back to where I'm from. Like, I get the sense he's killing them, though. I think they're crossed off of every, like, so an interesting thing here is when the movie opens, the pieces of art we see that Mandy is working on mm-hmm. is one of a phoenix being consumed by fire and a woman rising from it, like foreseeing her own death or depiction of how her death could be interpreted. You know, through her art. And then there's of a woman accompanied by like a giant wolf, like a dire wolf, and like depicting her relationship with Red. And you know, that like I think the chemist later says, you know, he identifies Cage as a warrior. Come to like, and so the entire thing is entering album like mythology. Warrior. Pardon?
A specific warrior too, right? A Jovan warrior sent forth from the eye of the storm, which is
Jupiter,
the eye of the storm on Jupiter, and like the planet that Mandy specifically says is her favorite for that reason. That conversation that they have about the stars, apart from it being kind of like an insight into like their kind of goofiness, can also definitely be read as like them picking the planets that they see the other person as, that they're interested in, right? Like Red is kind of that boiling storm underneath, but otherwise kind of, you know, still a beautiful planet. And then, which makes Nyx kind of like Red's, I keep saying just calling him Nick Cage, Red's choice of what was it, Saturn first, which is, you know, a very like beautiful planet, then switching to Galactus, kind of very interesting as
well, kind of a joke to tease her, but also there is a bit of like, I could have it all through destructive, like,
right,
mm-hmm. I could like an unleashed version of myself, which is kind of similar to like, he does it as a joke, but you know, obviously like by the end, Sand makes a speech that's similar of like, everything I want is mine, like that is right. What I do.
Yes.
And like without a shred of irony or humor, he generally does see the world and people in it as things to consume.
I mean, what is the last thing that Red says to Sand?
No, I can't remember.
I'm your god now. Red says, I'm right. Your god now, and then crushes his skull in his hands. Like, it's, oh god, the fucking,
we shouldn't, sleep on the grindhouse sensibilities of this film. Like, when he cuts the demon's throat.
Yeah.
And he just gets waterboarded. Absolutely. With the guy's arterial spray.
Yeah.
And everywhere. Like, eventually this gushing will stop, right?
It Nick, does not. Nick, let's run that one again. camera, there's a mess up. Let's blow it up the blood.
Yeah. It's a great kind of signifier too, because it never goes away. The blood stays for the rest of the film on all over his face, and it's just like him having gone through this transformation into this kind of righteous seeker of revenge that he is for the rest of the movie, just bathed in his enemy's blood.
His axe looks hella uncomfortable to wield.
It's so dumb looking. I love it.
It's
so wild. Stupid. It's incredible. The little grip.
Yeah, it needs to have a grip near the head just so you can grab it from anywhere.
But then he starts like doing like dual bladed lightsaber tricks with it in the fight with one of the black skulls. After, may I add, shooting that guy in the throat with his crossbow.
And again, just pulls the bolt. He just pulls it out. Like, oh, this is annoying.
Yeah, it's no big. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then this is why, like, again, I love this, the way that this movie, like, blends the magically real, like, like Patrick was saying, because, like, you have to, killing these guys requires you following magical rules of thinking, right? Like, the only way to kill this guy is to chop its head off, to chop his head off and, like, remove his power from the world. And I just think it's, I think it's really sick. And then he lights the fucking cigarette on the burning, head, which is like so stupid. Yeah. I love it. It's so good. What a good movie.
And I think for me, it reaches its height in that second half. Like, I don't think the second half is as interesting, but I'll tell you what did interest me. Chainsaw fight. And I was like, oh, like, you know, he's got his chainsaw. He's going to fight with that guy. He's going to use his chainsaw. And then it turned out there were two chainsaws.
And one of them
there was a bigger chainsaw.
Yeah. It's such a beautiful moment of just like, you know, because that, you know, we've all got that image of like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, like chainsaws as like a horror trope. It's always one-sided, right? It is the thing that the killer comes after their victims with. But then having two of them, he's both, you know, they're both the slasher in this moment. It's so good.
It's just unwieldy. Like, it's not, you know, yeah. It is when you see the, you know, in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, when you know that character runs around with it, it's unwieldy, but it is like an enormous person, like swinging this weapon with, like, they have the strength to do it and to enact the violence they want with it.
Yeah,
and what makes this fight so great is that it is like watching two people with sledgehammers
just like,
try and swing them around, and there is an inelegance to the fight that is really terrific, because that, I mean, again, that I think there is a through line from start to finish of Cage's violence, which is traditionally inelegant, but at least effective. And that is almost nowhere more seen than in the chainsaw fight. And I think that's what gives it its power, is because it really does feel like you're watching two people. Like, you can imagine yourself there, like, huh, Like, this is cool. You tell me chainsaw fight, I'm in. And then you watch two people try to fight with a chainsaw. And it's like, I don't know, maybe find a rock and just whip it at them. Like, this doesn't seem like it's necessarily effective at getting to the end state of this fight. But it is definitely fun to watch.
The other thing I like about this is that, like, the guy he's fighting, Patrick, to your point, is built like a slasher movie villain. He is a huge mountain of a guy. He is, like, so big it's silly.
Well, a lot of the sort of like side cult members have very much look like you're, you know, like backwoods, you know, Texas Chainsaw.
There's a lot of Deliverance happening here.
Yeah. Deliverance, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Like that is a lot of what these characters are seem styled upon.
Yeah. And like that is the fun thing is that like, in a way, the second half of this movie feels like a bunch of slasher film stock characters coming into contact with a Nicolas Cage stock character in a way that is like deeply, deeply engaging for me because it's just so fucking, ugh, it's so good.
And the value of the fight is resolved not through like, they don't chainsaw joust to the death. The guy falls on the chainsaw.
God. Yeah. That's so good.
Because Cage decides to use literally anything else in picking up that chain, which, by the way, so good. You know the minute he picks it. Ugh, God, I love a good chain.
Just like they keep showing that there's like multiple shots of the chainsaw rumbling on its own on the ground. And you're just like, oh, boy, here he comes.
And we just got a beautiful tableau of like, you know, he's falling on the chainsaw. And again, much like movie will not be rushed.
No.
We're going to watch his body like be just vibrated by the revving chainsaw as blood just like continues to spray out from under him.
Yeah.
And it rolls. Love it.
It's great. And then we get the you know, the final scene as he's entering this makeshift, I guess. Like it looks really, I don't know. The design is If it almost feels too designed to be makeshift, but I guess this is where they've been building their like little church out in the fucking wilds. It has that like, you know, this red glow that we've seen throughout the movie multiple times. It looks demonic, you know, despite having a regular crucifix and not an upside down one, but it really kind of, I love the way that it's framed by the mountains, like the whole, this is just like a beautiful shot of as he's entering it.
Please,
no, go ahead.
I was just saying, once we're in those tunnels though underneath the church, we are in dungeons and we are in Baldur's Gate, like yeah. Like we are in, that is a cavern. The walls are made of brick. We are in a crypt.
Once he goes north, it's like, north? What do we mean
straight
by
straight out
north?
Of reality? Yeah. Like the last, the last little taste of reality we get is the fact that his fight with the demons happens in a home and like place they've invaded at someone's home and killed the family who lived there.
Yes,
and that's our last tenuous connection with like a recognizable plane of reality that we're going to have. Chemist Lab is weird. It's like a sci-fi, you know, bizarre, pristine lab that appears to be like, you get a sense it's deep underground.
Also, he has a tiger. He just has a tiger.
But when Nicolas Cage arrives with his tiger shirt, it is time to release the tiger. Mm-hmm. He knows without saying. Yeah.
Well, this is the thing I love about that too, is like they have a whole conversation. You just don't hear it, you know? Obviously, they've both ascended because they've drank of the goo, so they could just telepathically communicate with each other. He knows what he wants. Oh,
you were wronged, man.
Yeah.
You were so deeply wrong. It's so good.
Another.
You could handle my strongest potion.
Couldn't keep the potion seller. I need your strongest potion. Just want to really quickly shout out another one of my favorite shots in this scene, and like another kind of threshold that they put up here when the what was he riding? Was it a motorcycle that he was riding gets stuck, or an ATV?
gets stuck in the like graveyard, and it like does this slow zoom out to show other cars that are just like in this sinkhole full of mud, but the only light in the scene is the headlights and the taillights of his little ATV. It's just, it's great. You see like scenes, the like use of kind of heightened diegetic lighting almost, but like every red is redder than you imagine the red lights on the car are, but like there's still, it's still like coming from that source in the world. Like it, I don't know, it's such a beautiful, really striking way to light a film, I think.
Yeah, it's like it's incredible. Like it's such a heightened sequence. Again, like I think the like tonally, the film is going to struggle to live up to the first half, and it's also going to struggle to live up to the highs of the chainsaw fight.
Yeah,
and so I think in a weird way, it's like, I don't know, that's a flaw, that it's a bit anticlimactic. Like, there is no fight to be had here, right? Like, this is, like, Sand is going to, like, try a couple strategies to get out of this. He is going to try his grandiosity you know, his sense of himself as a man with a greater destiny and a sort of a god on earth. That doesn't work. He starts pleading for the, like, I'll suck your dick, man. I'll suck your fucking dick. And, like, it's like, you already sent Marlene out to try that. That didn't work. And it's also kind of a revealing thing of like, this again is like how he sees the world. Just a, like, base appetites can be satisfied and problem go away, and doesn't understand, like, you know, we're so far beyond that. How do you think this is what this is about?
No. Yeah.
But he doesn't. Because
that's what it would be about for him.
For him. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. He's such a, like, childish man, like, pure id, that, you know, this is like what he thinks of as a way to, he can sort of spare himself before he returns to sort of grandiosity. And we just see him get his head exploded.
Yeah,
it's gnarly.
It is, absolutely. I love it as like a just kind of like definite portrayal of like the sort of, not strength, I guess power he had over these people was like fully in manipulation and like abuse, and without like his cultists to like protect him, basically he is like, you know, reduced to groveling in this moment. And it's just like the like quickness with which he's like trying to find any way out is very, I don't know, very like very satisfying to just see him like,
yeah,
like what he could do from a position of like power when Mandy cut him down. Like, he is kind of forced back into that position, but like as a means of groveling and trying to like find, yeah, like you were saying, find like he thinks there's a new pecking order and he has to be in that pecking order, and it's like, that's not what we're doing here, bro. I think we can check pause. In on a couple. Yeah, I was going to say, should we?
Oh, yeah, emails, yeah.
Yeah, we got some questions, and Red can jump in, okay. Whenever.
All right, I think we can go to a few questions. We got a few thank you to everyone who submitted one. Let's see here. Anonymous writes, one of my favorite aspects of Mandy is its lush, painterly, unrealistic use of color and light, which we don't often get anymore. Another recent example is Nicholas Winding Refn's Copenhagen Cowboy. Can you think of others? When do you think the current tyranny of realism in lighting will end?
Which I think we briefly brought this up, actually. I think, obviously, The Green Knight is a great example of this, where, like, when you want to get otherworldly light, like, they really push the colors in that movie as well.
Yeah. Sometimes this is a budget thing, right? Like, sure. I wonder, you know, you are almost pushed to use the resources you have to create the sensation you're going for,
right,
because you are less reliant on practical and visual effects that are going to cost more money. And I don't know how much Mandy cost to make, but my guess is it wasn't a huge budget, right? Like, it was, you know, something a little more reasonable.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think part of that is just simply out of, like, it's a way of, like, masking in a good way what you cannot accomplish by putting other things on the screen. Mm-hmm. And I wish more films had that restraint. It's frequently why I love lower budget affairs, because you get to see ingenuity come through in trying to portray what you might do differently if you were given a much bigger check. Maybe that is not the case. Like, you know, like this director, like the movie they did before this, Beyond the Black Rainbow, which, like, try as I might, I can appreciate that movie for its visuals, but I couldn't get to the other side of it. You know, I do think sometimes that comes out of it, but yeah, it spoke to, I enjoy it. I wish more films did that. I wish more films did that that also had a budget to go alongside it, so it doesn't always feel as though it is coming out of a you know, a lack of budget, and is more completely a choice of a portrayal.
Yeah, I think the other thing is, I would say, like, I feel like we don't live in the era of realism. Like, I think a lot of lighting and color choices are also painfully artificial. They're as distinctive as, like, 1960s, 1950s Technicolor films. It's just, whereas, like, you know, three-strip Technicolor is a glorious, saturated riot of color, a lot of the choices that we see being made around, like, digital color grading make things look like shit. And it also doesn't look real, right? Like, the world.
Frequently, it's not lit for the product that ends up. I mean, I think, like, the most, like, House of the Dragon, right? Like, the most recent, like, Game of Thrones spinoff had a sequence where it is these characters on the beach at night, and it looks like dog shit because you find out later it wasn't shot at night. Like, it was shot in, like, the daytime, and then they just, like, visually alter it later. And I think that is, you know, similar to a trend of what you're talking about, Rob, where it's like things aren't lit for what they're portraying. They're just shot and figured out later in post. And I think that leads to a strangeness in what you're seeing, and an unrealism that is harder to grasp.
And I do think the question askers trying to hit on a point of, like, even if it isn't realistic to, like, what that light would look like, it often isn't expressionistic the way these films are, right? Like, it's maybe there are color choices being made, but there aren't often, like, color isn't a main character, like, the way it was in Mandy. Like, it definitely, like, it, you know, commands, its presence is always important. Where, like, what you're saying, Rob, feels more like, even if it's not realistic, it's also not doing anything other than just being the choice that was made, kind of, you know.
Real quick, I think people want to look more into this. There've been a few people written about this, but Emily St. James wrote an article called "Colors: Where Did They Go?" An investigation over at Vox last January.
Perfect.
And it's like a discussion with a number of showrunners and cinematographers trying to get at, like, why do so many things have this, like, grimy, desaturated, like, color suppressed look.
Mm-hmm.
And there's there is no one answer. Some of it, right. Some of it is stylistic choice, and some of it is an effect of things that, like, it sort of an attempt to control things that digital can do wrong, or at least, like, that you will get effects you're not expecting with digital photography, and so you can course correct really heavy handedly with post process, like post production, like, color grading. Mm-hmm. So there's a few answers to that. But yeah, I think, but, like, you know, yeah, Mandy is such a striking film, you know, because it uses and leans on, that sort of saturation.
I think the only other thing I could think of that had some like really striking color moments in a similar way, or not even in a similar way, but in a different way was Fury Road, which is also like really plays with the saturation in different scenes.
Has anyone seen the black and chrome version, the black and white?
I have.
I've heard it's spectacular, despite not being obviously was presented in color, but I've heard the black and white version. Sometimes that's just a gimmick. Mm. You know, you'll see films like the black and
Logan
white version.
Logan Noir.
Right. But I've heard this version in particular is striking.
Well, do you know the other thing about the black and chrome version? It cuts all the dialogue. In terms of like all dialogue becomes silent and instead it's just the soundtrack, the moving image, and I believe some sound effects. It's a pretty like striking version of the film.
You could do a version of, I don't know that this movie would work in black and white necessarily. I think, you know, color is so specific to it, but you could probably cut a version of I actually think maybe I'm thinking of this because kind of someone asked a question about this. You could cut a version of it without any of the dialogue and you could probably put together something pretty striking.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think about the scene where, Red is screaming and they just cut the dialogue. They cut the sound of his voice completely, but keep the sound of brother something. I think it's John or something, whatever. One of the brothers, they keep his voice in there at just like normal volume. The things that this movie does with like sound and what sounds are allowed to be heard by the audience and which ones are completely cut is like really, really striking.
Speaking to that question, also anonymous, do you think that the dialogue in Mandy is necessary? Other than dialogue, the sound design is so abrasive and menacing that I've imagined a mostly silent cut of the film's protagonist, minus Nick's laughs, cries, and screams, of course, should make the experience even more heightened. I feel like in the first half of the film especially, it sets up too many stakes, honestly. Like, I do think that the emotional core gets lost if you don't have the dialogue of the first half, but...
Also, like, I don't know. I think Red has some really good monologues. Like, there are some really good monologues in this movie, even if they aren't, like... There are some very well-delivered monologues that I want to be able to hear. When Red walks into the room with Jeremiah Sand and says... The psychotic drowns where the mystic swims. You're drowning. I'm swimming. Is just like, I need that line. I need it. And then it begins this like monologue duel where Red and Sand just like enter debate me mode and just start like screaming evocative phrases at one another before Red ends up killing him. And I think that like that scene is just like so integral to like the vibes of this movie.
Like the way I think about it is like the black and chrome version of Fury Road, which is that it is not a replacement, it's a complementary piece, it's a reinterpretation of the work. And so I don't think you'd make a better Mandy by removing that, but I think you could make an interesting take on Mandy by rearranging the pieces and removing the dialogue and like really just emphasizing the visuals and the sound design. If anything, it'd be the kind of way that like I might rewatch it more because it's the kind of thing that could just be on, right? Like in there, as opposed to being fully present for watching, you know, the film and taking in all the dialogue portions.
I'm just imagining a version of Patrick who's like doing a secondary task, like cooking dinner, and he turns to his left and he's like, oh yeah, it's that scene where that guy gets chainsawed. Hell yeah.
Yeah.
If nice.
If my children could handle it, that's what would be happening on the screen. Like you know, Shudder, the horror, sub has like a television feature, which is like, hey, we're just throwing movies. And I love that idea of just having things on in the background, whether it's sports or a person, you know, getting a pike through their eyes, you know. Different vibes for different days.
All right. Blake in Texas asks, or comments and then asks, from the moment I saw the poster for Mandy, I knew it would be incredible. Did you know that the director's dad, which we spoke about, this is George Cosmatos, who did Rambo First Blood Part 2, Tombstone, and one of the greatest VHS cover sci-fi movies ever, Leviathan.
What are your favorite films based entirely on the cover / poster? Did y'all see the poster for Mandy? Good one.
It's really good.
Yeah.
I feel like I will say I did grow up outside of the era of like covers and posters, which is tough because I think they're really sick. But when I was a kid, like my grandmother really loved them, but she was the person who would buy movies based entirely on their covers and actors at Family Video. And I was the person who did the same with games. And so I can't really think of any like favorite film posters.
Yeah, because you grew up in a trailers are everywhere sort of era where like us growing up, like you saw trailers, I guess at the beginning of a VHS tape or at the theater, mm-hmm. like yeah. at most. And so trailers really didn't mean anything until like, I remember like the earliest days of downloading Apple like QuickTime trailers at like postage stamp sizes was like my first experience with digital trailers and being like this shit fucking rules. Trying to think.
Couldn't you like download? Am I misremembering that you could download a trailer for The Matrix or something?
That was one of the early ones, I think. but the QuickTime, like I remember, like Yahoo, like there was you know like Real Player and things
right,
like that.
Real
like,
Player. QuickTime had the best.
QuickTime had the best quality.
Yeah.
For all the trailer stuff. I do know, like I remember growing up, I was very taken. Let me find the cover to it.
I could do this for books.
This movie, which this none of this is a surprise to anybody here. Carnosaur.
Oh my god. Look at that guy.
Driven to extinction, back for revenge. Jurassic Park was, you know, one of my all-time favorite movies as a kid, still remains one of my all-time favorite movies. And so basically walking up and down the video store with anything with a dinosaur on it was immediately appealing.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when I eventually saw the movie and like this is like what we're working with.
That's here. Amazing.
The puppetry is maybe not as good as what Stan Winston was producing with Steven Spielberg. It's probably a movie I would enjoy a lot more now than I did at the time because I was like desperately searching for the experience of Jurassic Park somewhere else. And was not getting it from Carnosaur necessarily. But every time I'd walk past that box art, and finally I convinced my parents, like, I don't have nightmares. Like, I'll be okay. And they're like, fuck it. Like, you can watch this movie. I became way profoundly disappointed. But you know what? You know, maybe my turn will be a chance to revisit. It's not my turn, but how do I connect my turn to Carnosaur at some point? One can only dream.
I love this poster, Patrick, specifically for one of the poll quotes, which is, thumbs up, terrific. I like this movie, period.
Period.
Yeah, but can we look closer at who said it? Zoom in.
Wait,
enhance.
Wait, open in browser.
Gene Siskel
and Ebert. What? What are we doing? That's incredible.
What year is this movie?
1993.
Okay, no, I don't think he had brain cancer by then.
Jesus Christ! Oh my god! All right, let's do another one here. Here's one from Chris from question mark. After a screening of Mandy, they showed a Q&A with the director and star, and Cage was asked about his dream. Dream role currently is. With no hesitation, he said that he would absolutely kill it as Captain Nemo in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Does the Waypoint crew have any roles you'd like to see him cage up? Love the My Turn series and keep pointing the way, Chris. He's done so much already. Yeah. I feel like, especially in recent years, there's been like an even, you know, Cage-a-sance, a Nick-a-sance.
But like in an appreciative, like yes. I think there's been like a real effort to, like even in that movie, you know, Renfield that came out, that apparently is not very good. But like it's so like, man, I'll watch that when it comes out on HBO Max just to see him do his best David Bowie impression
sure.
as Dracula. Like that sounds, you know, entertaining. I mean, mostly I think about pairing him with directors, yeah. right? Like we just watched The Lighthouse, but I would love to see Robert Eggers do something with Nicolas Cage. Like,
damn.
Because like Cage gives as much as he gets, right? From mm-hmm. the material and the filmmakers that he works with. I think part of the reason that Mandy works is like Cosmatos is an excellent filmmaker and is like asking him to go to a place and extracting that out of him. Like that is just kind of the actor yeah. Cage has been. Like, sure, you can say, oh, I guess he's just like, you know, taking these cheap roles and whatever. But like the man loves to act and just like clearly just wants to be on screen and like keep inhabiting different roles. And so when I think about modern filmmakers that are able to pull that out of people, like Eggers is absolutely one of them that I would just love to see what Cage would do when paired with a filmmaker like that.
Yeah. Oh, please. Please.
Sorry. Oh, for me, I think it'd be like, and I just looked to make sure they hadn't worked together. And no, but this is someone that Cage has is sort of on record as wanting to work with. But like, I would love to see Cage in a Spike Lee movie. Like that is because like, I think there's yes, the like we've gotten a lot of like somewhat taciturn Nick Cage performances of late, and then a lot of his more verbose roles tend to be really heightened and broad, like see Bad Lieutenant, etc. But I'd be so curious what like a Spike Lee script draws out of him, because those movies are stylized and they're stylish, mm-hmm. but they're also very chatty. Spike Lee's movies exist a lot in like dialogue and monologue, and I would like love to see Cage get a like meaty role in, you know, really like any kind of movie that Spike Lee makes. You know, he's made like more studio films like Inside Man, and then there's like the more personal stuff and more like you know, class and race specific stuff like Do the Right Thing. But there's a gamut of, you know, experiences between there. I would just love to see Cage in a Spike Lee movie.
Mm. I'm trying to think of who I want to see him paired with.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, when I think of, like, what do I want to see from Cage, it is something like a movie that is, like, fully built around him. And that is like y'all said, pulling something different out of him. I did check one thing. I didn't realize that he was in. I didn't realize that he. I guess because I didn't recognize him in Raising Arizona. I did not recognize him in that movie. Mm. I would love to see a modern Nicolas Cage in a Coen Brothers movie. I think that'd be really. I think that'd be really really fun.
Yeah, revisit the yeah.
God, I feel like they could do such a good job with taking a Nicolas Cage stock character and making a black comedy film about what happens when that person comes into contact with normal people. I think that'd be really fun.
Well, and also that would take him. Even Mandy itself is genre fair, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's he obviously excels and enjoys being in that. Like he was in another terrific horror film, Colorado Space, an adaptation of the Lovecraft story. That movie is directed by a horrible monster that taints everything about that film, but he gives an incredible performance in that movie that I quite liked. But there's so much, and like genre obviously like works to his palette as an actor, but I also think he's getting a little pigeonholed in that. Yeah. In that sense, and I love like that's why the Coen brothers strike me as such an interesting pairing, because even Eggers is. You know, closer to the genre fair, and like he can do big, broad comedy and drama. He has just not really been given the opportunity, and he's very funny. Like, he's one of the highlights of Into the Spider-Verse. Like, I saw him bitching about that he's not going to be in the sequels. He's like, I don't know, yeah, I guess not, and which is unfortunate because, like, I think that was a really, you know, how many times are my kids going to be exposed to Nicolas Cage? And it delights me to no end. like when I see my kids cracking up at his character in that film, because he's genuinely funny.
Yeah.
We may need Ren's pick.
I was going to say, I think
fuck.
That'll take us to the end of this episode of my turn. Next up, we've got Ren. Have you made a choice? Have you considered during this time?
I've been considering. I don't want to go with the easy one because I feel like we've done the one that I proposed at the beginning of this podcast. I think we've done it before, right? For something.
Oh, you can just say it. Annihilation.
Annihilation. Yeah, yeah. We've done it for something, right? Was that part of the Stalker?
I don't think so.
No.
I think we discussed it as like, you know, in conversation with, but not. I don't think we've done an explicit discussion on Annihilation, and I guess I'm surprised it wasn't a Waypoints because that's around the same era.
Yeah, exactly.
But I could have sworn there was something, but it wasn't big enough to like really stick in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was debating between.
It's probably just a mention of it, ultimately.
Annihilation and Arrival, just to give people an idea of where I'm at, because I think Annihilation is a really, like, excellent film, and I've never seen Arrival, and I would love to hear another...
You want to hear another score?
Yeah.
Yeah, you would.
Yeah.
The score on that is great in that film.
Fuck. You know what? Let's go with Arrival. That's where we're going. Yeah. Well... Patrick, do you still want to do the thing that you wanted to do?
I don't. I am fine with dead kids in films.
That's not what I meant. But okay.
Oh, I thought this was maybe like a warning. Like, Patrick, that movie does open with something horribly distressing happening.
No. That's me asking if you still plan on going to the film that we had previously suggested you would be going to. Because I'm trying to figure out which has the best connective tissue to where I know that you wanted to go previously.
Oh, don't worry about it. No, don't. We're good. If you want to do Arrival, that's fantastic. I think that's a great choice.
Let's do Arrival. Hey.
Yeah.
Next week it's next week.
Next time. I keep doing it. It's
good joke. Next time it'll be my turn, and we're going to watch the 2016 science fiction language film Arrival.
All right. I'm going to time that is. Mokado, you're the captain today.
Oh, I have to pull up time that is. God damn it.
You motherfucker.
Oh, that's right. Well, you don't need it. All right, let's just go on 40.
Wow. That's so long from now. There it is. There's so much space.
Can't believe you talked over our clap.
Yeah, great producing right there. Gets into the host chair and just...
Yeah, no, the clap is totally
clear. They're talking lumpy on our tracks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they've got the little marker.
I know what I'm doing here. I know what I'm doing here. It's fine.
I just think it's uncouth. Kata, you're completely
the woman who brought an entire breakfast sandwich into the podcast. it can't be uncouth. Over our clap. That's uncouth.
Damn. Let's make points and not eat breakfast on the podcast.
I know, I'm sorry. Mm.
Oh dear, have I betrayed a small psychological pet peeve? I have.
No, that's totally fine. I'm sorry. I'm really done.
Okay. Right.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.